was friendly towards the Germans and who did an awful lot for the prisoners. In Buchenwald, the Nazis had set up a real theater, a stage with an orchestra pit for favored prisoners at the time, and also for the people who worked there so that they got a bit of entertainment. The camp commandant sorted all of that out. At first, for his Russian soldiers, his guards, he put on little clownish skits, dressing up, things for circus acts, a bucket of soapy water over the head, that sort of thing. Now, you must realize that there were people like Heinrich George in the camp. We had a director from the Nollendorf Theater who was an inmate, and we had people from the Philharmonic Orchestra people, and the Russians supplied them with instruments. They just went out and took violins and flutes from private individuals and brought them to the camp to put together a wonderful band. It was primarily meant for the Russian soldiers, but more and more German things crept in. The camp commandant allowed the theater director to rehearse a German play. 8 days before it was to be performed, one member of the theater group, a female prisoner, was caught with a Russian soldier. The soldier was sent away, and the girl was immediately removed from the theater troupe, so the play had no lead, and they needed a substitute at very short notice. I was asked if I was able to learn it by heart. "Of course I can," I said. In the camp, of course you had thoughts about things. Another year gone by, and you're still here. What will I do when I go home? Will I be able to do a job again? I already had one. I had to help out in a tailor's workshop organized by the Russians. I wasn't inactive for long. Meanwhile, I was often very lucky. I came back in January 1950 and threw my hand over my mouth when I heard about everything that had happened. Suddenly, there was a new radio station, and they even took me on as a secretary. When I came back, I thought at first I might be able to start at the station Rias, Berlin. No, they certainly wouldn't be taking on any former Nazis. You worked in the propaganda ministry, you're a Nazi. Fine, then I'm a Nazi. But they made no exceptions. But then I ended up at Südwestfunk, as some people there knew me from before. They were former workers who had reported in propaganda units and about the war and were already back at work. I don't remember exactly everyone who managed to get out of the propaganda ministry. Kurt Frohwein managed, but I never saw him again. And Naumann too. He was with the Führer in the headquarters until the end, and he managed to get out of Berlin with Martin Bormann and Schwegermann. Dr. Naumann contacted me when I was already in Baden-Baden. "Dear Fräulein Pomsel, I am glad that you were one of the ones who survived that terrible war, and that you are doing well again and have found a very nice job in the Südwestfunk. I would be very happy if you would contact me. I have met up with some very good friends again." Naumann had also met Werner Titze, who was the editor-in-chief at Südwestfunk and a schoolmate of Naumann's. They were both born in Görlitz and probably met up again by chance in Bonn. Then they ran through the people from the Reich Broadcasting Corporation and the propaganda ministry who they knew or didn't know, and my name came up. Luckily, I went to my former boss, Lothar Hartmann, the director of programs with whom I later went to Munich. I asked him what he thought about it, and he advised me against contacting Naumann. So I didn't. And just a few days later, I read in Der Spiegel that he was involved in a conspiracy to infiltrate the liberal FDP, Free Democratic Party. He was still a Nazi. I never heard of him again. They were all a few years older than I was, and they're all dead now. It comes up again and again in the papers. Someone turns up Nazis who worked in German law courts even later on after the war. Many people were very skilled at shaking off responsibility. I didn't understand that. And I didn't see any reason to do it either. I really found out about the most terrible things only after I came out of prison, about the extent of the persecution of the Jews and the camps. Until my release, I didn't speak to anybody. No relatives, no colleagues, nobody. I was in the hands of the Russians, and that was that. Everything that came after, the Nuremberg trials, a new currency, the GDR, German Democratic Republic, I only found out about that when I came home in 1950. Put 24 marks on the table in front of my mother and said, "Mama, that's what I've earned in 5 years. They had paid me that on the last day, in fact. My mother said, Child, you can throw that in the waste paper basket. That's Eastern money. There were funny details, I remember. At my first dinner, Mama, since when have we always eaten white bread? She said, white bread, that isn't white bread. It was normal bread. But for me, it was white bread. Can you imagine what we got in the camp? It was black bread. But what black bread? For me, this was a completely new, altered world. When I was being questioned, I was also asked if I had a cyanide capsule on me somewhere. Nobody ever offered me one. I would have accepted it, but not for me. I didn't plan to take my life. But perhaps I would have taken it in Sachsenhausen. I'd really reached my limit there. It was 3 months before I was released. I had a knife, which you weren't supposed to have. A blunt knife. I clearly remember playing about with that knife and thinking, how do you open your veins? But a blunt knife isn't going to be much use. So I only played with the idea, and then I put it away again and thought to myself, no, no, I'm not going to do anything as stupid as that. Basically, I don't tend to throw in the towel that quickly. I remember a secretary of the Führer's writing about how proud she was to have been given a capsule like that by Hitler. But no girl from the propaganda ministry made it over to the Führer's bunker. I was often very lucky. Sooner or later, there was always a way out. I was often in a state of despair, but somehow or other it always passed and let me become what I am now. Of course, I'm no longer that naive little girl who finds the world great fun. I've encountered the world from all sides, from many sides. Then there was Eva Löwenthal, who was never out of my head. What had become of her? Only decades later, visiting a cemetery in Berlin, I found out what had happened to her. I looked around the cemetery and went to one of the attendants to ask whether she might be among the missing. I only had her name and her approximate age. I'm missing someone called Eva Löwenthal, I said. He went to a machine with a list of names, and we found her. A year older or a year younger than me. According to the list, she had died, and it also gave the year. It was right at the end of the war, early in 1945. We couldn't find out anything more than that. Eva had always sat at the table with the rest of us. She was part of it. She was an intelligent girl, she had read a lot, and she often made me feel stupid. I thought, you with your basic education, and now she was actually dead. At the time, I couldn't grasp it. The persecution of the Jews hadn't been as active in my district as in others. Most had left in time. They had money and connections abroad. But mostly they kept themselves to themselves. They were self-contained. For example, the circle of acquaintances of my boss, Dr. Goldberg, who invited me to his little parties. That was the whole clan of the Leiser Shoe Manufacturing Company. They bred like rabbits, bringing lots of children into the world. They didn't even allow their financial interests to merge with those of other people. And so for schooling, most of the Jewish children attended private schools. Eva was someone special as far as we were concerned. We knew she needed a bit of protection and she had no money. She couldn't even apply for a job. When you applied for a job, you had to reveal what faith community you belonged to. That was how it was. But those differences also existed among the Jews. There were a lot of poor Jews too, like Rosa Lehmann Oppenheimer. She had that little shop selling soap. I liked going there as a child. Her shop always smelled of paraffin, and she herself did too. Still, when she reached into the big sweetie jar with her hand, which wasn't always very clean, and then pressed a whole handful of unwrapped sweets in your hand, of course she was the loveliest person in the world. Rosa Lehmann Oppenheimer. She was taken away, I was told later. She was one of the poor Jews. They existed too. After Hitler came to power, it was too late for everything. Brunhilde Pomsel. I wasn't guilty. The CV of a 103-year-old woman. It's like everything else. Even beautiful things have stains, and terrible things have bright spots. It's not all black and white. There's always a bit of grey in both. I never went along with the crowd. I was only in the crowd when I did gymnastics, when I went on jaunts, when I played bridge. Then we were a delightful crowd. I'm essentially a loner. I've never married or brought children into the world. Not because I have anything against marriage, and I would have liked to have a child. But in the old days, you couldn't have a child without being married. It would have been a scandal, and I never wanted to expose myself to that. But I like being alone. I always have done. I think I had that desire even as a child when I didn't have my own room. Always with the boys, and it was always so cramped. I wanted to be alone a lot, but I also liked spending a lot of time with nice people. It might be selfishness of some kind, but at least it wasn't selfishness at other people's expense, because of course you were part of a crowd in spite of everything. I'm not that kind of individualist. As long as I can do the things that fulfill or inspire me and don't have the feeling that I'm being bothered by the crowd, I'm happy to get involved. If I hadn't been at the propaganda ministry, the story would have been exactly the same. It's not just about me on my own. Every individual belongs somewhere. Of course, there's always an influence of some kind. Sometimes it's upbringing, sometimes the circle you're part of, I don't know. In Germany before Hitler came to power, life wasn't particularly open. It was a completely different world back then. Many people nowadays can't even imagine that restricted life. It starts with the upbringing of children. If they were badly behaved, they got the slipper. Love and understanding didn't get you very far. From a clip around the ear to trousers down, 3 smacks, and that was it. And you didn't resent it. Who in those days had friends in America or anywhere? A school friend of mine trained as a hairdresser. And even as an apprentice, she was lucky enough to be able to travel on the Bremen, an amazing ship that traveled between Germany and America. She was envied for having such a great job. None of us knew any foreigners. At first, there was no broadcasting, not to mention all the other technical nonsense that they have today. Nothing. We were still living on an island. Not just us. Other countries were exactly the same. There wasn't that network except in trade, and that was a separate class. We were undeveloped. Today, no one could hope to escape the modern world. I expect young people or the next generation just think sensibly about these things. Of course, we're always subject to certain influences. At a certain age, most people are enthusiastic and they commit themselves to something. But it doesn't last. Afterwards, when life becomes more serious for them, and they have to assume responsibility, perhaps they even want to have a family, then it slowly stops. What happened back then only happens when you have discontented crowds. They have time to take to the streets. I never used to take an interest in politics. Now that I'm older, I'm more interested in political developments. Before, there were more important things for me to think about, personal things. Germany was punished for its national ego and its deeds, for its negligence and its apathy. I don't think that would happen very much these days. It's hard when you've passed through a period like that, a trough like that. In the end, however, it is still my only life, my fate, and in the end, everyone only thought about themselves. Sometimes I get a bit of a guilty conscience. Sometimes it's your own fault, and then I think you actually came out of it well every time. I knew more about those terrible, ugly things than the average person. But I always survived that too. If I was a young person now, I would do things differently from the way I did them before. Things start much earlier than they did, not least young people getting involved in everything like broadcasting and television. Perhaps these days we have more control of our own fate. Everything in me revolts against the improbability that there's someone who decides our fate. It's a gruesome idea that there is a personality, God, who decides that such terrible things should happen. I'm not thinking about what happened to me. I was only unlucky, but nothing was terrible. On the contrary, I sometimes made things difficult for myself by being sensitive. Some people criticized me for my big nose. Sometimes they either didn't see me at all. I was so small and inconspicuous. But people liked me. All the more, the better they got to know me. At least, that's what I imagine. I also had an inferiority complex in various ways. I do have a certain confidence. I admit I've got that. I think I'm a good comrade. I've also done a lot of good in my life. Assuming I'd married and had children. I don't know, you can't say what kind of partner you would have had. I wouldn't have been able to think as much about myself as I have done. I've fulfilled many of the desires that many people have to forego because of illness, children, unhappy marriages, and so on. That's also made me a little cowardly. I haven't been inclined to take risks. I've got a certain caution and a certain cunning. I'm not proud of anything, but in retrospect, I'm always glad when I've done something. I'm not the kind of person who absolutely has to make something happen, but when I've succeeded with something, well, if I'm content, that's a nice state to be in. But I answered that constant question of guilt early on. No, I don't feel guilty. Absolutely not. Why would I? Now, I wouldn't describe myself as guilty. Unless you're going to accuse the whole German people of helping that government come to power in the end? That was all of us, including me. It was never my personal wish to go to the propaganda ministry. It was an order, a compulsory instruction. And no one can imagine what that meant at the time. I was ordered to go there. I didn't apply for it. It was a transfer. And I had to go along with it. If I'd said, I don't want to, they'd have said, what do you mean you don't want to? That's not an option. Clearly, in the department that I belonged to, the current affairs department in the corporation, there was no work left in 1942. There were spin-offs when staff members who were also housewives brought the vegetables that they'd planted and harvested in their gardens into the office. And since they had no bosses and weren't getting any dictation, they chopped the beans and filled their preserving jars and then carried them home again on their bicycles. So it wasn't hard for me to leave the department. My men from the corporation were all gone. All gone. They were all in the war. The lucky ones were in Paris, and none of them forgot me. We all dreamed of getting back together when the war was over. I had to earn money somehow, and it had all been very respectable and decent. Ending up in the propaganda ministry was all a bit naive on my part. I sometimes was a bit naive, but I don't feel guilty. If I did, I would have repaid my debt a million times. I don't think people would be so stupid as to fall for that again. I can't imagine it. I mean, I'm still aware of the crowd as a crowd. But I also see people being very sluggish and a bit lazy about thinking and being critical. As long as they've got enough to eat, everything's fine. If someone takes care of some of their concerns, what happens sometimes in politics? And if not, who knows? I sometimes wonder how young people, these are observations that I've made from watching television, how they deal with such problems. We didn't do that. Not at all. They all seem much more mature to me, and I'm very much aware of that. I wish our own upbringing had been like that. But we had to be more obedient in those days, and things are more relaxed about punishment and sometimes strictness. Everything works better. There is more order. Whether that's worth striving for is a whole different question. But very often when I see young people on television, school students debating, I think, my God, what confidence they have, an ability to engage with the life that lies ahead of them. We were stupid in those days. There wasn't time to think about everything. Ordinary people would be thinking about when they had to go to work. In my circle, we were largely untouched by problems. They didn't burden or preoccupy us, the way they preoccupy me now that my life is behind me. I'm much more interested in them now. I'm just trying to explain to you how, as a young person who is simply released into life, there seems to be some kind of direction. But it doesn't always need to be an influence. That's easier to observe in the present day. Today on television, I saw school students who were trying to persuade strangers about the coming elections. I admired the boys and girls there above 16 years old. The older people were often very dismissive.
I'm not interested, stop bothering me, or things like that.
They just ignored them. Those young people were so eager as they approached old and elderly people and tried to point out problems to them. They didn't have things like that in the old days. We were left to our own devices. Unless you joined the Scouts or the German Girls League. Personally, I didn't want anything to do with any of that. I didn't want anything with a uniform, marching with the crowd. I'm someone who is able to think the way young people think. I have a lot in common with them. I'm not one of those adults who see children as know-alls or not mature enough to make a judgment about things. I think children are aware of a great many things. Sometimes they don't even need to be 10 years old if they fall into the right hands, so you can tell what's going on in their minds. If I just think about my own upbringing, I can't imagine my father ever discussing such matters with us. We were never allowed to know what party he voted for. There were elections often enough. We always wanted to know, how did you vote? And he would always say, that's none of your business. You can't do that. If things had been different, I might have developed differently as well, and I might have wanted to become something more responsible and paid more attention to who or what I was working for, what I was getting into. I was always very frisky and a bit shallow. Well, it helped me too, my nature. Today I can see that that was all very superficial. Before, there was no propaganda ministry, and now there is no propaganda ministry, and the world doesn't miss it either. It was an absolute invention on the part of those crazy Nazis. They were the worst kind of egoists. There was no love of the fatherland, none of that. Only egoism. Quite terrible. Not a trace of idealism. I didn't know any of that in those days. But I don't feel guilty about any of it. I didn't do anything. I don't feel guilty. All the many people who are often disparaged as Nazis, what are the people as a whole? It's like a sea, everyone together. It's a constant movement back and forth. Only certain personalities had an effect on me. Those generalizations like the guilt of the German people, that's all nonsense. We are guided by a certain class of egoists. Sometimes they are gentler, sometimes more brutal. If you think back on history, what the ruling class did in the past, I can't imagine anyone would deliberately accept something like that, become an advocate of those things. That's not what I am trying to do. But who can know everything? I may have worked with more criminals in my life than I know. You don't know that beforehand. During the time when I was working for Goebbels, of course he was one of the big bosses right at the top as far as I was concerned. For me, he came just after Hitler. And the orders came to me from the ministry, as they did for every soldier who fired at Russian, French, or English soldiers, and that doesn't make them murderers. They were doing their duty. I could really only reproach myself if I had unjustly hurt somebody very badly, and I can't remember doing that. Simply speaking, there was nothing we could do. After 1933, it was too late. Of course, I could have gone to see Eva Löwenthal every day and helped her, but she wasn't as close to me as all that, and we couldn't really help her anyway. If she smoked away the little that she earned rather than at least going to buy something to eat, then we can't help her, we thought. We were very quick to judge. The example of Eva is only supposed to bring clarity. There will have been many examples of friends who went on supporting Jews. Some people even put themselves in danger, as we know from everything we discovered later. But people today who claim they would have done more for the poor persecuted Jews back then, I'm even willing to believe that they are honest about it when they say it now, but they wouldn't have done it. After the Nazis were in power, it was as if the whole country was under a bell jar. We are all in a huge concentration camp. After Hitler came to power, it was too late for everything, and everyone had his own personal issues to deal with, and not just the persecution of the Jews. There was so much else as well. There were the many fates of one's own relatives who were at war, but that isn't supposed to excuse anything. Apart from the Nazis themselves, the leaders of this movement who worked with false, completely false prophecies, It is the indifference of the people that made it possible. I'm not trying to link that with individuals by any means. The indifference of people, which you see over and over again, that we are really in a position to see on television how this terrible story is playing out in Syria. Hundreds of people drowning, and then there's a variety show. We don't change our lives because of it. I think that's just how it is in life. Everything is all mixed up. The best thing that you can blame some people for, they were idealists in those days and so blind in their faith that they really believed Germany was on the way up. Because by then we were people who lived very modestly. They believed that. I'm sure there were a lot of people who believed out of a true love of the fatherland, out of genuine conviction, that a group of men, by taking charge of everything, would do everything better. If I had been able to guess or know everything back then, I certainly wouldn't have gone to the Broadcasting Corporation or the Propaganda Ministry. For me, Goebbels was a politician who tended to shout a bit loudly. I didn't think about it at all. I also never listened to all that Kotzwollop, his speeches. Everyone was saying the same things. I don't listen to speeches in the Bundestag either. It's all just claptrap what they come out with. I can't give you any advice to young people today. I don't need to influence anybody. I don't need to affect anybody. I have no obligations. I can think for myself whatever I want. If someone just lives for themselves and has no interest in these subjects, then he doesn't exist. It's a bit different if you live in a community. A community is a kind of family, or if you're younger and you have more friends that you can talk to, but I'm now excluded from all that. Here, I can't talk to anybody anymore, and if I have visitors, well, we talk about other things, even today. But blind obedience is a bad thing in every situation. In certain matters, you must obey, of course, but you can't just say yes for the sake of comfort. I have never had children, but if I had, I would have made them get involved very early on. We were brought up too much to be obedient people. You are, of course, very dependent on the circumstances you grow up in, the way everyone develops outwardly and politically in a human sense. I'm coming to terms with everything as it is now. I sometimes envy people who can always find comfort in their faith. I don't have that. I always say it's chance. Anything that I myself didn't bring about is pure chance. People today are offered so many possibilities that they can get confused. They can't always tell if everything they're offered is a real opportunity or not. I do have one piece of advice, though, something that doesn't exist in practical life. There is no justice. There isn't even any justice in the legal system. To begin with, opinions about all kinds of things change, and they're in constant flux. In the past, homosexuals were either something laughed at or said ugh about. Now they're even having children. It doesn't surprise me at all. So much happens in life that you couldn't even have imagined 50 years ago. I've always thought that I can learn, but now I find it hard to use my mobile phone. I've got so stupid in the meantime. Sometimes I wonder why I've grown so old after all I've been through. I'm such a weak old thing. Who can't push gates open and can't really see anymore and can't really walk because I can't really see. It's still not over. I sometimes wonder whether I'll die in my sleep, maybe when I go to sleep. I can't imagine dying of an illness. I think I'll go in my sleep, but I really don't care. 2013. In November 2016, Brunhilde Pomsel gave another glimpse into a personal conflict that perhaps reveals a very individual aspect of repression as a survival strategy, and which was also presumably no less crucial for the overall picture of being unwilling to look and just getting on with the job. Before the 1936 Olympic Games, she met Gottfried Kirchbach in a pub in Berlin. Gottfried Kirchbach was a German printmaker and illustrator born in Munich in 1888, and the son of German painter Frank Kirchbach. Among other things, he worked for the Propaganda Stuttgart Advertising Agency and designed election posters, for example, for the SPD and the USPD. He had a Jewish mother and therefore was a half-Jew by the racial laws of the National Socialists. He knew very well from the stories of Brunhilde Pomsel what the plans were for the Jews, even though he himself had not suffered any reprisals. He also knew what position Brunhilde Pomsel was in at the Reich Broadcasting Corporation, but the two of them barely spoke of these matters. Without revealing any further details from the everyday life of that relationship under the strict racial laws, Pomsel describes how after the 1936 Olympic Games, Kirchbach moved to Amsterdam to escape persecution by the Nazis. Brunhilde Pomsel was ready to follow him with packed suitcases, but he turned against the idea. He first had to sort out his life in Amsterdam so that he could look after a family. A pregnant Brunhilde Pomsel was left behind, but had to terminate the pregnancy on the advice of her doctor, as her lung disease made the prospect of giving birth to the child too dangerous. She describes it as a painful process. She and Kirchbach saw each other a few more times in Amsterdam before it became too dangerous for her to keep taking regular trips without arousing the suspicion of the authorities. After the outbreak of war, contact was severed and she never saw her lover again. Gottfried Kirchbach died in Amsterdam in 1942. For the rest of her life, Brunhilde Pomsel lived alone and childless. She died in Munich the night before International Holocaust Remembrance Day, on the 27th of January, 2017, at the age of 106. What the story of Goebbels' secretary teaches us for the future, Tore D. Hansen. More than almost any eyewitness of the Nazi regime, Brunhilde Pomsel openly admits to her opportunism. She places her own advantage, her youthful egoism, in the foreground in order to explain her lack of interest in politics and her later role in National Socialism. The experience of poverty, the fear of social decline, and a longing for affluence and advancement run through her childhood and youth to her adulthood. Her professional progress was the most important thing to her, and she preferred to look away rather than to engage with the deeds of her boss Joseph Goebbels and try to find a way out for herself. Goebbels was one of the main architects of National Socialism. Film and radio, the new developments of the 1930s for reaching the masses, were deployed for propaganda purposes and for the indoctrination of the German people and particularly for the defamation of Jews, communists, and other marginal groups. Goebbels' anti-Semitic propaganda was the ideological preparation for the later Holocaust of the Jews. Even today, his speeches are considered exemplary in terms of how they manipulated the population. You might ask incredulously, how can a young woman who lost her lover and a good friend because of political circumstances not see clearly the man she worked for? She carried on with a sense of duty and an extreme distortion of the facts before ending up as a prisoner in a special Soviet camp, standing under a shower not dissimilar to the one under which her friend Eva Löwenthal was presumably gassed. And yet she doesn't appear to grasp exactly what happened. At the premiere of the documentary film A German Life, viewers and journalists warned against all-out condemnation of the aged former secretary of Joseph Goebbels. They did this in the awareness that, even in our own times, ignorance, passivity, and apathy have spread in the population, while other parts of society are becoming radicalized. Paul Gabulski of Vice magazine summed it up. I have always tried to protect myself from others, and it is the ordinary person in me, filled with sufficient weary absurdity, who paves the way for betrayal and the violence of entire armies. Let us pay attention to the little bit of Pomsel within each of us. Brunhilde Pomsel tells us how she became what she is through her childhood memories. She was born in Berlin in 1911, the daughter of a decorator. She describes her frugal life after the First World War and the global economic crisis in the 1930s. Even though her family was relatively well off, she felt a growing yearning for affluence and a career. She was shaped by the child-rearing methods and strictness of her father. If one of the five children was badly behaved, they were smacked without further ado. Love and understanding didn't get you very far. Obedience and a bit of cheating, fibbing, or shifting the blame onto someone else were also involved. The National Socialists immediately put the blame for the state of Germany in the 1930s onto a concrete group, the Jews. Brunhilde Pomsel has a clear answer for those who claim today that they would definitely have acted on behalf of the Jews. But people today who claim they would have done more for the poor persecuted Jews back then, I'm even willing to believe that they are honest about it when they say it now, but they wouldn't have done it. After the Nazis were in power, it was as if the whole country was under a belgia. We were all in a huge concentration camp.
After Hitler came to power, it was too late for everything, and everyone had his own personal issues to deal with, and not just the persecution of the Jews. There was so much else as well. There were the many fates of one's own relatives who were at war, but that isn't supposed to excuse anything. In response to the question of how Hitler's rise to power in the 1920s should be explained, and why it wasn't possible to stop him, there is agreement in only one respect. There are no simple explanations. It was neither ideology and propaganda alone, nor Hitler's suggestive power, nor the terror of the SA in the streets, or political and social circumstances, nor simply the humiliation of the Germans by the Versailles Treaty, or the communist threat or mass unemployment. None of these circumstances on its own explains the National Socialists' rise to power, but taken together all of those factors had a deadly effect. Immediately after the Second World War, the chief concern among the architects of the new constitutions in Germany, Italy, or even Austria was to ensure that the new democratic systems could not be undermined by extremist movements, and that history could not repeat itself. As probably the last eyewitness from within the Nazi power apparatus, Brunhilde Pomsel gives us the opportunity to understand why right-wing populists, authoritarian systems and dictatorships are reappearing in the 21st century, why this has been occurring on an international level for a long time, and what the causes for it might be. It would be premature to claim that history is repeating itself, but it is as inappropriate as it is negligent to ignore the many indications that feed the fear that Europe might finally collapse, something that could give rise to military conflict. If we look at Brunhilde Pomsel's most harmless and banal-sounding memories and reasons for her rise in National Socialism, there are comparisons with the present day. Large parts of the population of Western democracies can barely be bothered with facts and tend to be driven by emotion. A sense of injustice can radicalize entire population groups, and in the end it only takes the creation of a suitable image of an enemy to win those groups over for simple solutions. The story of Brunhilde Pomsel can be seen as an example of the need to argue for the preservation of an open society. For long passages during Pomsel's descriptions, one has the feeling that she is not expressing herself honestly. Certainly, she has attempted to repress details of her work. And yet, her knowledge of what was happening in the propaganda ministry lingered inside her for decades afterwards. It's hard when you've passed through a period like that, a trough like that. In the end, however, it's still my only life, my fate, and in the end, everyone only thought about themselves. Sometimes I get a bit of a guilty conscience. Sometimes it's your own fault, and then I think, you actually came out of it well every time. I knew more about those terrible, ugly things than the average person. She tells us very little in precise terms about anything more concrete she might have learned. If Brunhilde Pomsel actually didn't know anything, it's not because she couldn't have known, but because she didn't want to know. We didn't want to know much. We didn't want to burden ourselves even more unnecessarily. It was enough that we had to do battle with a lot of difficult things, since food supplies were getting worse and worse. I was such an idiot back then. If in that difficult time, when so much had to be thought through and overcome, if you got into a conflict about having done everything wrong, you didn't even want to admit it to yourself. What she could have known has been amply covered elsewhere. We could hardly have expected new facts about the history of National Socialism from conversations with Pomsel, as she didn't want to talk about details or couldn't remember anything. What makes her statements so valuable for our own times can be found between the lines, because in spite of all the gaps in her memory, she has in the end reflected upon her life. In a certain sense, she has delivered an unusual and sometimes apparently harsh confession about her role. But of course I'm guilty in the sense of being stupid. But it wasn't what everybody wanted. They promised themselves a new revival after the loss of the First World War, and at first that actually happened. A re-blossoming of a humiliated people who had lost the war and not gained some of the rights that could have grown out of the treaty. When Brunhilde Pomsel claims to have known nothing about the true extent of the persecution of the Jews, we could rightly point out that she, of all people working in the propaganda ministry where facts are embellished and news suppressed or invented, could very easily have known all kinds of things if she had wanted to.
From 1942, rumors were spreading across the whole of the Reich that the Jews were not being resettled, but were being put in concentration camps. Anonymous surveys, even into the 1990s among eyewitnesses of the last century, revealed that up to 40% of the German population knew about the Holocaust before the end of the war. But Pomse could also have looked unobserved through the files dealing with the trials against the White Rose or other trials at the notorious People's Court, rather than putting them in the safe, unseen, and being proud to have followed the instructions of her superior and thus gained his trust. The desire for personal recognition and her blind sense of duty towards her superior took precedence in the young secretary. It was a bit of an elite. That was why it was very nice working there. Everything was pleasant. I liked it. Nicely dressed people, friendly people. Yes, I was very superficial in those days. Very stupid. Her superficiality at the time is the only criticism she makes of herself here. While she dismisses any idea of personal guilt for the crimes of National Socialism, she would only accept such a thing if you accuse the whole German people of helping that government come to power in the end. That was all of us, including me. This attitude, of course, ignores the fact that everyone must be ultimately answerable for his own decisions and his position in society, both then and now. But Brunhilde Pomse's assessment is correct in terms of the result. Because without the support of large numbers of the population for the Nazis, along with a simultaneous lack of interest in the true goals of the movement, presumably history would have been different in the 1930s. Is a lack of interest in politics a fault in itself? As far as the question of the lessons that we can learn from her biography for our own time goes, it does not matter whether she was a convinced National Socialist or not. She clearly wasn't. Between actively joining in and actively looking away, the question of her guilt blurs into a self-protective assertion of personal stupidity and naivety. From a moral point of view, looking away is a fault, because life always means living with others. That is true, not least in a democracy in which universal human rights are an essential pillar of fundamental rights. But currently, many people are turning away from the democratic system because they do not question the mechanisms that lead to the breakdown of social and human solidarity. Or perhaps because they don't want to question them? In Pomse's life, or at least so it seems, little mattered apart from her own advancement. And now that was my fate. Who is in control of his fate in such agitated times? Very few people can say, I did this and this for that and that reason. It just happens to us. Hitler's secretary, Traudl Junge, claimed to have known nothing about the Holocaust, and the telephone operator of the Führer's escort command, Rokus Misch, said many times that he never heard anything about the final solution in the presence of Adolf Hitler. Common to them all is the fact that in the end they were either ashamed of their past, took no responsibility for it, or hid away from it. Even now, there is barely any direct information on how the so-called final solution was really discussed in Joseph Goebbels' circle of staff members. Even if it were true that only Joseph Goebbels' personal advisers, not the secretaries, knew about the plans for the destruction of the Jews in Europe, it is difficult to put much faith in Brunhilde Pomse's claim that she knew nothing about it. Since the notes of Goebbels' diktats, which have been passed down to us, are not initialed, it is now impossible to tell who recorded them. But it is very hard to imagine that a secretary working at the top level wouldn't have known what was going on. There are many accusations that might be leveled against Pomse. She apparently distances herself from her own past, perhaps because she wants to examine her unconscious guilt at having been there. She had almost 70 years to come to terms with things. The fact is that she served a man who seduced and manipulated a whole people and drove them into the abyss. She repeatedly and definitely denies any personal guilt in the crimes of National Socialism, and also insists that she knew nothing about them, perhaps making it easier for her to deal with the truth. For long stretches, she succeeds in doing this far more successfully than many other servants of the Nazi leadership managed to do after the war when they tried to cleanse, deny, or even just whitewash their biographies. I may have worked with more criminals in my life than I know. You don't know that beforehand. During the time when I was working for Goebbels, of course, he was one of the big bosses right at the top as far as I was concerned. For me, he came just after Hitler.
and the orders came to me from the ministry, as they did for every soldier who fired at Russian, French, or English soldiers, and that doesn't make them murderers. They were doing their duty. I could really only reproach myself if I had unjustly hurt somebody very badly, and I can't remember doing that. Her story gives us the opportunity to see what happens when the emergence of a dictatorship is ignored, and later what it means to live, or survive, in that dictatorship, both physically and mentally. But it also makes clear what it means to watch today's populists strive to bring an end to Western-style democracy. Pomzel, who died in January 2017 at the age of 106, should interest us because her openly expressed cowardice and apolitical attitude reveals something that has been flourishing for some time, even today. A great indifference or a political weariness and apathy towards the fate of refugees. A blazing hatred directed against democratic elites. And the new rise of right-wing populists who have declared war on democracy and European integration. Her unreflective egoism and the enticing job offer from Wolf Blei, as well as the desire to rise through the ranks and to belong, were major reasons for her joining the party and the broadcasting corporation. That's how she slipped into it. It was thanks to that lucky encounter with Wolf Blei that I had a contract, and a very nice contract too. Oh, I can't remember how much exactly now, but anyway, I was making over 200 marks a month. That was crazy money. Compared with what I had got by on for years, it was a princely sum. At first, I worked for the board of directors and then in the office of the former directors. That wasn't terribly honorable in itself because there were people there who were due to be shunted off. All the secretaries who had been senior in the former broadcasting corporation. They had worked for the Jews because most of the board members had been Jews, who had all been thrown out or sent to the camps or at any rate out of the broadcasting center. In search of parallels between the 1930s and the present day, we inevitably find ourselves confronting certain questions. What is happening in Europe and the United States? Are parts of the population, most of whom have not yet been radicalized by the new demagogues, in the end just as passive, ignorant or indifferent towards current developments as Pomzel described herself and those around her when she was aged 22 to 34? Is youth today just as apolitical, and is the political disenchantment of the middle class the actual threat to democracy? Have the democratic elites failed by ignoring the long-term consequences and causes of an increasing political disenchantment? Are we returning open-eyed through our passive attitude and apathy to the 1930s? And can we really draw conclusions for the present day from Pomzel's biography, conclusions that will stir us into action? Anyone who does not wish to see totalitarian states emerging should take the experience of the 1930s and Brunhilde Pomzel's life story seriously. In our own times, we are seeing a dictatorship emerging in Turkey. In the end, it is people like Brunhilde Pomzel who have, at the behest of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, brought the opposition, parliament, and the media under the sole control of the president to ensure Erdogan's power. We don't know how much opportunism these police officers, functionaries, and other henchmen displayed or had to display just to live or survive in Erdogan's new system, but they are calling democracy into question. In the southeast of Turkey, according to estimates from Amnesty International, within a year, as a consequence of brutal intervention by the Turkish authorities, about 500,000 Kurds have been driven from their homes. An approach like this amounts to collective punishment. Tens of thousands of people, including civil servants, teachers, scientists, and politicians, were dismissed or imprisoned after the attempted putsch in 2016. The death penalty is due to be reintroduced. The Turkish parliament has been stripped of its power, and the powers of the president have been strengthened. These are all signs clearly reminiscent of the Nazi dictatorship under which Brunhilde Pomzel began her career in the Reich Broadcasting Corporation after it was cleansed of Jews. What we are observing in Turkey is also happening elsewhere in the world, but we are talking about a country aspiring to membership of a community of democratic values, the European Union. Fear of the refugees who are trying to escape the civil war in Syria to reach Europe is a factor in the fate of the European democracies. European states forced the European Union to strike a deal with Turkey, which has been used by the Erdogan administration to resist external involvement in Turkish domestic matters.
Refugees from the Syrian war zone, human beings, are becoming political pawns. The threat on the part of the Turkish state leadership to reopen the borders to refugees is creating a panic elsewhere in Europe, particularly in Germany. But in almost all European countries, the idea of taking in even more refugees is being firmly rejected, partly because of the fear of a further rise of right-wing populists. So fear makes us indifferent towards human rights. The ugly German of history is back in the form of the radical Pegida and parts of a radicalized AfD, Alternative für Deutschland. People with an immigrant background watch the rise of parties such as the AfD with growing concern and wonder how safe they are in Germany. They are worried about whether attacks by the terrorist regime of the so-called Islamic State will turn the national mood against all immigrants, as the right-wing populists use every means at their disposal to gain ground. Democracy is the constant attempt to safeguard and protect the rights of the individual. The new right-wing populists, should they come to power, will deny individuals these rights again, and the old anti-fascist warning, "Resist the beginnings," is being uttered far too late. When the chair of AfD, Frauke Petri, posited the possibility of using firearms against refugees, against people fleeing from one of the worst civil wars of the modern age and from failed African states, it portrayed them as fair game. With slogans spreading like wildfire on the internet, more and more people are seeing refugees as bogeymen, and the process of brutalization continues. Austria saw a presidential candidate, Norbert Hofer, from the right-wing populist Freedom Party of Austria, FPÖ, threaten on several occasions to dissolve the government and hold new elections in the event of his victory, with the aim of bringing the right-wing populist FPÖ head, Heinz Christian Strache, to power as chancellor. Even though Hofer's opponent, Alexander van der Bellen, managed to mobilize enough electors to prevent a right-wing populist victory, the election result, 53.8% for van der Bellen versus 46.2% for Norbert Hofer, was close enough to be extremely alarming rather than a sigh of relief. Just under half of the Austrian population voted for a right-wing populist who tried to canvass voters with the slogan "Austria First," and the expression of xenophobic sentiments, and effectively with only two campaign themes, the battle against the old establishment and smear campaigns against refugees. In large parts of Europe, refugees are isolated in mass accommodation with no personal dignity, or, as in Hungary, fought at the borders by police and soldiers with tear gas and truncheons. As well as over 400,000 deaths in the Syrian civil war so far, the number of people who die trying to escape to Europe from war and misery is rising daily. This also includes the refugees from African states. The number of dead and missing refugees in the Mediterranean was about 23,000 in the period between 2000 and 2014 alone. The monthly newspaper Le Monde Diplomatique gives the figure as 23,258. But it wasn't only the sea that proved to be a potential death trap. Hundreds died of hunger or thirst, cold or hypothermia, or suffocated in trucks, or were killed when crossing minefields. According to UNHCR estimates, between 2014 and 2016, another 10,000 people drowned while escaping to Europe, and there is no end in sight to these statistics. The refugee situation is one on which Brunhilde Pomsel gives her own view, taking into account her own experience. "The indifference of people, which you see over and over again. That we are really in a position to see on television how this terrible story is playing out in Syria. Hundreds of people drowning, and then there's a variety show. We don't change our lives because of it. I think that's just how it is in life. Everything is all mixed up." If we pick out key statements and events from Pomsel's biography, we will have a clearer sense of why the behavior of each individual will be of central importance for the further development and fate of the Western democracies. In European countries, the majority can still set the tone. Liberty, equality, fraternity, the demands of the French Revolution, are also the basis of the European democracies. But their continued existence is by no means certain. If, during times when it is important to stand up for these democratic values, people remain silent and passive and switch over to a variety show, a radical minority will go on defining political daily life with slogans, hatred, and harassment of everyone who doesn't fit with their view of the world. They will go on poisoning the political climate, win more and more support by spreading lies and hatred, and possibly, in the end, come to power. There is a danger that with our indifference and passivity, we will maneuver ourselves into a moral debacle in which shocking events become routine, and concern for our own safety means that refugees and their fates will be objectified, stigmatized, and in the end, dehumanized. And all the humanism that has been built up in Europe in the 70 years since the Second World War will be lost in the search for a simple solution. Turkey's threatened collapse back into dictatorship, Brexit, the departure of the United Kingdom, the second biggest economy, from the European Union, the governmental crisis in Italy, the break with democratic principles and the rule of law in Hungary and Poland, the election successes of the AfD in Germany, and the narrowly prevented victory of the FPÖ in Austria, as well as the feared successes of the right-wing populists Marine Le Pen in France and Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, are, taken altogether, the greatest challenge to the preservation of lasting peace in Europe. This is because the declared aim of the right-wing populists is the end of European integration and a return to nation-states. If a party such as the AfD gets over 20% of votes in the German state of Saxony-Anhalt in March 2016, this percentage offers the potential for a right-wing revolution, even if part of that number is unthinking protest vote. That is precisely where the danger lies. The rapid rise of the AfD recalls the speed with which the NSDAP worked its way up in the Weimar Republic. First, they had 18%, then 30%, and with the election victory in 1933, democracy was over. No one should be so naive as to assume that the AfD will find no more followers after a certain point, or that it is out of the question that the FPÖ will have the Austrian chancellorship within the foreseeable future. Across the whole of Europe, we are seeing democracies becoming unstable, and this also applies to the previous gatekeeper of democratic principles, the United States. The Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump was elected president after he identified Muslims, Latinos, and other minorities, as well as the old establishment in Washington, to be responsible for the decline of the American dream. Explicitly, that of the white middle class. After Trump's election victory, Richard Spencer, figurehead of the ultra-right-wing, alt-right movement, called for his supporters to party like it's 1933, the year Hitler came to power. The Trump movement feeds not only on fury against migrants or refugees, but also on rage against the democratic establishment. Donald Trump, with his slogan, Make America Great Again, brought a broad range of aggrieved Americans into the election booth, with racist slogans against Muslims, Mexicans and Latinos that are no different from the slogans that European right-wing populists use. Why shouldn't that work equally well in the United States, Donald Trump may have thought. During the caucuses, he exploited the frustration of white workers and the white middle class with sexist and racist slogans to ensure votes for himself. The disparagement of whole population groups was suddenly acceptable, since this was no longer a social class struggle, but a cultural struggle in which the white population sought to resist the achievements of the liberal age. The integration of foreigners, as well as the rights of women and homosexuals, everything suddenly was and remains up for discussion. This is effectively the dissolution of solidarity. Brunhilde Pomser's memory of Joseph Goebbels and his speeches, as well as the reactions of the whipped-up masses, allow us to observe one certainty. The seduction of a people by demagogues with simple and radical solutions works now just as it did back then. The fact that Pomser only slowly discovered who she was actually serving correlates with her self-confessed naivety, which brought her to the Reich Broadcasting Corporation and later to the Ministry of Propaganda. I discovered his true nature only very slowly. I remember the famous event at the Sportpalast. Do you want total war? It was really an outburst, like an outburst in a mental hospital, I would say. It was as if he'd said, now you can all do whatever you want. And then, as if every individual in that crowd had been stung by a wasp, all of a sudden everyone let themselves go, shouting and stamping and wishing they could tear their arms out. The noise was unbearable. My colleague stood there with her hands clenched. We were both so horrified by what was happening. Not by Goebbels, not just by the people, But by the fact that it was even possible, the two of us weren't part of the crowd. We were onlookers. We were perhaps the only onlookers. That one person was capable of putting hundreds of people in a state where they were shouting and shouting and shouting. Yes, we...